music. Martha's Table is all about supporting strong children, strong families, and strong communities. And we want to celebrate all the amazing father figures out there who make a difference in the lives of their children and families. So let's come together and have a blast at this awesome celebration. For more information, visit www.marthastable.org. See you there.
Yo, peace, this is Rod Stars.
Peace, this is G1, and together we're Rebel Diaz. When we in the DMV, you know we're listening to that People Power Radio, WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice. Let's go.
This is a journey.
Redeem a full of culture.
I got so much trouble on my mind. Refuse to lose. Here's your ticket.
He is amazing. I didn't know nothing about it.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Say what you say, say what?
I don't want to be like Mike.
Before Magic's knees go permanently south for the winter.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Changing up the guard quicker than fear brings down doo-doo.
With the finger roll, what's the foul?
Hey, young bro.
He never saw Elgin Baylor play during his day or Oscar Robinson.
Flash the dice roll back. The big O was jackknifing through all them bodies.
I didn't know nothing about it.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Collision. This is where sports and politics collide, here at your home for jazz and justice, 89.3 FM WPFW, where we aim to change the world one broadcast at a time. I'm usually joined by my man Chuck Modiano. I'm usually joined by my man Etan Thomas. Thrilled this week to be riding alongside the great coach Kevin McNutt. How are you doing, Mr. McNutt?
Doing well, brother. Great. Wow. That's big coming from you. You don't put that kind of butter on me, man. But anyway.
I don't know. I'm just feeling grateful for everything you bring to the table. What can I tell you?
Let's see. After we get into some of these discussions, if you feel the same way by the end of the show. But anyway, that's
believe me.
Let's go to work, man. We got a lot to cover.
We do. But by the end of the show, trust me, you're going to be probably kicked off the air. So that's, you ask me why am I buttering you up now? For the simple reason that I can be cruel later. You got to be cool, and then you get cruel. That's how I operate.
You better ask Mike, Magic Mike. He know about me. We from the same streets. I got friends in low places, buddy.
You do have friends in low places. You do know low places, sir. On that we shall agree. And also, I promise that the only quoting of Garth Brooks songs will be done by Coach Kevin McNutt, not by me. We've got a heck of a show this week. Look, everybody knows what we have to talk about. Today is game one of the NBA Finals. We're going to have to do our preview on that. We're going to need to talk about the Negro Leagues. We talked about it last week. Coach McNutt has things he wants to say about the fact that Major League Baseball is integrating the Negro League records into their records books. I want to hear what Coach has to say about it. I don't even know what Coach is going to say about it. I just know he has things he wants to say about it. There is so much toxic, poisonous discourse about the WNBA happening right now. Mm. We're going to talk about that. And at 10:30, I'm so excited. We have an interview coming all the way from Turkey, with legendary hip-hop artist Brother Ali. I just can't believe that we have such a packed show and such little time to do everything in, because everything I just described, Coach, is not even the first thing we're going to talk about. Uh-huh. How crazy is that? Because we have breaking news. Mm-hmm. Breaking news. I wish I had a little noise like like back when you were growing up, Coach, and they would do the, you know, it's like, you know, you'd be watching one of your two channels and they would break in with the emergency news.
Hey, old is good, baby. Move on. Let's go.
Moving on.
We got
moving
work
on.
To do, man.
The news is that the Los Angeles Lakers, the glamour franchise in all of sports, has looked like they're zeroing in on a new coach. Everyone mm-hmm. thought it was going to be former Duke basketball All-American J.J. Redick, who is now mm-hmm. a podcaster and the former mm-hmm. NBA player who loves the sound of his own voice. But it's not J.J. Redick, the pseudo-intellectual gas bag, J.J. Redick.
Did you say J.J. Redick?
J.J. Redick. That's actually a good name for him. J.J. Redick, a man who's never held a coaching job, who they were about to hand the most glamorous job in sports because he does a podcast with LeBron James? No. That's not what we're looking at. The breaking news is that the Lakers are circling around Danny Hurley, the top coach in all of college. Two straight titles at UConn, won by record margins. LeBron apparently loves him. Danny Hurley wants to go to the NBA, according to the reports. Bronny, LeBron's son, is somebody who LeBron thinks Danny Hurley can develop so they can take Bronny in the second round.
Mm.
That's a big part of this story, is LeBron thinks Danny Hurley can help Bronny meet his potential, and then LeBron and Bronny can both play on the Lakers, becoming the first father-son to ever play on the same basketball team. Now I bring it to you, Coach. Mm-hmm. Your thoughts, please. What do you think about the fit of Danny Hurley, the control freak Danny Hurley, incredibly intense Danny Hurley, the kind of guy who looks like he could just stare at a nail and not need a hammer for it to enter a piece of wood, Danny Hurley, going from coaching these kids in Stewart's, Connecticut, to Los Angeles to coach LeBron, Bronny, and the Lakers. Yep. Coach, your thoughts?
Yep. Terrible fit. I don't understand it. I understand it from, by the way, I hadn't even considered the Bronny factor, because Danny Hurley will do that. He will make him a better player. That's what he does. That's how he's won two titles at UConn. But it's a terrible fit. Early on, matter of fact, I've never heard him say he had NBA aspirations right now. And he's the king of the hill, as you said, top guy in college basketball. Kentucky came after him. Arkansas looked at him. But he didn't want to leave because his wife and family, they're entrenched in the New Jersey, New York area. So moving all the way to L.A., I don't understand that. Now, everybody has his dollar. Everybody has their price tag. But mm-hmm. I don't see it as a good fit. He, like you said, he you're dealing with young men, 17 to 19, 20, 21. Now you're dealing with pros that make more money than him, depending on his contract. I don't see it. Yeah. He is a yeller, screamer, tight control guy. I just don't see it. And before I let you jump in here, Dave, the only comparison is Billy Donovan, of course, who won back-to-back titles. But Donovan did it in 06 and 07 and didn't leave college basketball until 2014 after a Final Four appearance. Now, and right now he's on King of the Hill. Now, on the negative side of that, I have to say, by the way, Donovan has been very successful. He won all 5 years. He was OKC. But he never won a title. And he never made a deep run in the playoffs.
Never.
Now, one of the other reasons that might be leading Hurley to look at this is college basketball is a mess. NIL guys getting $2 million. I don't understand it. It blows my mind. The portal guys are transferring, you know, coach yelled at me, I'm out of here. I mean, it gets that silly. So outside of that, what say you, my brother?
Well, you're making some terrific points that I was going to make. So therefore, I now have to dismiss them as inferior points. Because isn't that the way this is supposed to work? I'm sorry. I'm new to the Sports Hot Take Factory, but this is an important story because you mentioned Billy Donovan as the only comparison. I've been trying to think of comparisons as well that make a lick of sense. Billy Donovan's the closest one since he was the last coach to win consecutive titles at the collegiate level. Mm-hmm. The difference between Billy Donovan and Danny Hurley that I have to say that's very important is that, first of all, who is Billy Donovan's mentor? Rick Pitino, somebody who had tremendous experience coaching in the pros, who could give him the 411 about what it's like. Billy Donovan, also best player on a Final Four team at Providence in 1986-1987, the captain of that team. Billy Donovan, also, people forget this, was the backup point guard on the Knicks, backing up Mark Jackson for a couple of years when Rick Pitino was the coach in New York. Yup, I got all the receipts. How many people remember that? I remember it like it was yesterday.
I didn't. Go ahead, Dave. Roll, boy, roll.
There you go. There you go. So having some idea of what it means to coach in the NBA was something that was already a part of Billy Donovan when he made that leap. Look at Danny Hurley instead. Barely played in college. Son of an all-time high school coach, Bob Hurley, legend at St. Anthony's. The brother of Bobby Hurley, who coaches, I believe, at Arizona State.
Correct.
And Bobby Hurley is somebody who, because of a tragic car accident, his own NBA career barely happened.
Correct.
Now, bring this back to Danny Hurley. What does he know about coaching grown men? Because everybody knows, and I'm going to say something. If you're going to be a great you mentioned about college is a mess. I want you to talk more about that. But everybody knows that coaching at the collegiate level is about inspiration and X's and O's and teaching. So you have to inspire young people, you have to teach young people, and you have to know your X's and O's. In the pros, what's the number one thing? Well, you can ask Jason Kidd for the Dallas Mavericks what's the number one thing. It's having a relationship with your stars. And getting your stars to buy in on what you want to do. Jason Kidd can have the greatest game plan in the world. If Luka Doncic and Kyrie Irving thinks he's full of the funny stuff, they are not going to listen to one word he has to say. And the team will implode, and Jason Kidd will lose his job no matter how much he yells, no matter how much he rants, no matter how much he raves, no matter how much he says, it's either him or me. Can you imagine? I'm sorry. Yep. It makes me laugh, the thought of him saying that.
Right.
Now, if Danny Hurley has buy-in from LeBron James and buy-in from Anthony Davis, I see a LeBron James who's almost 40 years old. I see an Anthony Davis who just had his least injury-plagued season of his career, and would that possibly duplicate itself again? I'd say no, and I see this not going well at all. All the stuff that Hurley, my point is just that all the stuff that Hurley is known for and good at aren't necessarily valuable commodities at the professional level.
Correct. 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 And you mentioned the Bronny factor. Okay, so what's the priority? Is LeBron won a championship here and want his son to develop and play with his, you know, and play with his son in the NBA? Because Hurley hits that, he checks that box. But if he wants to be an NBA, and you can, I like the way you laid it out, he has no, there's a learning curve. You know what I mean? You can't just walk in there and then you're going to take this team to the title. You don't know about playoffs. You don't know about seven-game series. You don't know anything about that. There's a learning curve. There's a training ground that he has to go through. So that's another year. That's why they got rid of, I'm drawing a blank, Dave. Help me out, the coach.
Oh, Darvin Ham. Darvin Ham.
Yeah, Ham. And he had the credentials, but he needed a learning curve from being an assistant to a head. Now you're talking about a college guy coming in. What does he know about a seven-game series? You know, there's a learning curve, and you have to give him some time. And LeBron knows the clock is ticking. Like you say, he's almost 40. So
yeah, that's my point. That's my point that's key, because if LeBron is 26, I might be like, wow, this might work. Because if LeBron is the one choosing him, if LeBron is the one who admires him, and that's all the reports, that LeBron is just besotted, like it's Valentine's Day in 1965, and he's just, you know, he loves him some Danny Hurley, loves the way he strategizes, loves the way he thinks. Well, guess what? It's going to get old very quickly with the team if they feel like this is just some LeBron James vanity project where at age 40 – he gets to play with his son, and they get to make their Ken Griffey Jr. History and play on the same court.
People
do all those things and saw LeBron James. It's the greatest accomplishment, and all that will be true. The idea of in a sport like basketball, where people retire in their early 30s, who go to the Hall of Fame, who retire at 31, 32 years old and go to the Hall of Fame. Like, it's not like baseball. I mean, it's sport with all the wear and tear on your body. And you get to play long enough to play with your child? Mm-hmm. It's an amazing accomplishment. Absolutely. I don't want to denigrate it for one half of 1 second.
Right.
But I also know that the fit, it's still a team game. And I wonder about the Rui Hachimuras, the Austin Reeves, you know, the D'Angelo Russells, even the Anthony Davis, about how long they're going to be happy being the supporting characters on a vanity project. It reminds me of like those Hollywood directors from the 1970s, and they're given all the money and all the power to make the film they want, and it's a big box office dud. That's what I see here. Now, I was hoping you could say something before we go on this topic. I think both of us are of the same mind on this, which is rare enough. But yes, I would love to hear your words on what it is about the college game, because you're such a fan of the college game, that would be driving Danny Hurley from his safe environs in the tri-state area to restart life in Los Angeles. That's a pretty extreme reaction to a college game that has served the Hurley family very well. Exactly. So you tell me, what is it about the college game that's pushing him to the left coast?
The only, because he's king of the hill. He's acknowledged as the best in the business right now. The only thing that I can see that he understands, and that's why, you know, Kay got out, my man at Villanova, Jay Wright got out, you know, even they say at North Carolina, I'm catching them so fast, the coach at Carolina that left, these old heads, because they saw what was coming, this freight train coming down here, downhill without brakes, of NIL, of the portal. It is really, really, you lose control, and he's a control freak, and you lose control, but he's handled the portal well. In the last 2 years, he's been able to get a part and piece, and he's not going in and getting 7 guys, 8 guys, which some coaches are doing. Matter of fact, Calipari had to do that at Arkansas, so he's been able to manage it well. He's kept kids. He had one guy go to the pros here, one and done. That helped him win a championship. That's going to be in the draft, the number 3 player in the draft. Castle. So all that.
Very good player.
The downside of college basketball, but he's at the king of the hill, and he's mastered it so far. Even this year, he's lost a lot of players, but he's been able to, you know, target guys. They've come. I don't hear the lavish numbers of $2 million to come in and play for a guy averaging 7 points a game, which is floating around out there. So he's been able to master it. So I really don't see this. I think it sounded to me they got beat up so much about the Redick deal that, okay, well, here's Hurley. How do you feel about this one? Like, you know, testing the waters of social media or something. I just don't see it.
Well, I will say this, the contrast with taking a JJ Redick is pretty intense, because say what you will about Danny Hurley, and we are certainly saying a lot about why this is a bad fit. Danny Hurley's resume, as you just said, is the top of the mountain resume. Right. And JJ, if that's the top of the mountain, JJ Redick is like the bottom feeder at the bottom of the mountain. You know what I'm saying? JJ Redick, to me, I mean, brings nothing to the table whatsoever other than being loving the sound of his own voice and the fact that LeBron loves him as well. Now, everybody says, people smarter than me say that JJ Redick is really smart about ball. People smarter than me say that. That being said, there's a big difference between knowing a lot about ball and leading a group of people who also know a lot about ball.
Right.
JJ might be better at articulating it, but let's be honest. Everybody who plays in the NBA is basically a hoops genius. Maybe they can't articulate it like JJ, but they know more about the game than I will ever learn in 1,000 lifetimes just by virtue of playing it.
Absolutely. Now, and you have to give JJ his props. He's unlike a Hurley that you mentioned. He was at Duke 4 years, and I'm sure he's talked to Kay on a regular basis. And I like his broadcasting like this. And people have brought up Steve Kerr, for example, not Mark Jackson. There was another guy that came from the booth and went to NBA coaching. But we're talking about a different thing. You got to realize what we're doing here. We got LeBron, you know, on the clock, chasing Jordan, or you know, wanting one more ring before he gets out of here, if not two to tie Jordan. And that's a pressure that You better pay. You better have a lot of zeros on that check.
No, exactly. Well, let's move on from this. We're of agreement because time's a wasting. People get our point. People can email me at edgesports@gmail.com if you're part of the J.J. Redick extended family or if you went to Duke and this upsets you somehow. Go on. I know Mike thinks, Magic Mike thinks, that my love of LeBron James might also be coloring my thinking. And you know what? That's very fair. But when you've entertained me for 20 years, you earn some benefit of the doubt. But at the same time, oh, man, I think his head is getting a little fuzzy when it comes to playing with his son. And he's thinking about that more than he's thinking about what his team is going to say about having this intense college guy come in and start doing some rah-rah stuff. But I digress. Move on. We got 10 minutes. We're talking Negro Leagues. We did a show about this, me, Chuck Modiano and I, where we talked in effusive praise about the fact that Major League Baseball will now be integrating the Negro League records into their records. Now, when you ask, hey, what's the best hitting season of all time? It's no longer Rogers Hornsby hitting 424 in a segregated major leagues. It's Josh Gibson hitting 466. All-time hitting for a career used to be Ty Cobb, 369. Now it is Josh Gibson, 372. Negro Leagues getting their due. Chuck and I were doing handstands and cartwheels. You've got something to say. I respect you, Coach. I don't agree with you, but I respect you. And I frankly respect very few people. So, no, I'm just kidding about that. Everybody listening, our audience has my respect. But I throw it to you, Coach. Why are you feeling a little squirrely about the great Negro League statistical integration?
Okay. Because it's validation, for one. I also think that I want people to understand what they went through. And I want that to be front and center. I think that gets lost when you just say, okay, their stats are good now. Who said it? You made a point yesterday that their stats are not through 48 or not. They stopped at 48 instead of 52 when the league actually disbanded. I'm saying, okay, and all of this, I don't understand. And then here's a question. And before I really articulate my point, I want you to answer me this. In 1971, Satchel Paige went into the Hall of Fame. He was followed by Josh Gibson and Buck Leonard in 72, Monty Irvin in 73, and Kupapa Bell in 74. There are 35 Negro League players in HOF. So now, that was in 71 when that happened with Satchel Paige and the other guys, 72, 3, and 4. That's 50 years ago. So what's going on now that their stats are good, they can be inducted into the Hall of Fame then with their Negro League stats, and now they're not? Answer me that one, Dave. I'm puzzled by that, first of all.
With their Negro League stats, exactly. Let's talk about this. Let's really talk about this then, because I think you're making the argument less that these stats should not be included, and you're more making the argument that I believe, that I was arguing last week, the other week, that the pace of change in Major League Baseball is really embarrassing.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I see it. Because think about it like this. Major League Baseball was integrated in the 1880s with Moses Fleetwood Walker and his brother as well and several other players, but most prominently Moses Fleetwood Walker. And then Cap Anson, who is in the Hall of Fame, led a push by white players to put down the color line, and the ownership of baseball was only too quick to agree. Mm-hmm. So the color line came down, and then it took not only another 50 years for Jackie Robinson, 60 years for Jackie Robinson to break the color line, but it also took, and we forget about this, World War I and World War II.
Yes, yes. Yes.
Black men dying for this country and not able to come back and play baseball. Black women serving this country and yet not even having a place in the All-American Girls Baseball League.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that was, of course, famously shown in the movie A League of Their Own. So to me, this is a condemnation a condemnation of Major League Baseball's slow progress, even in quotes. Now, that being so, I think that's the reason it's taken 50 years, because they are so slow to bring the kind of consciousness and respect to these records. Now, the thing that people are raising is saying, well, it was an inferior brand of baseball. And that's please, where please, I have to push back.
Yeah, and my pushback too. As a matter of fact, and watch this. See, because if you're going to tell the story, you got to tell what these men went through. And first of all, it is an American success story because they were denied, but yet the league was very successful. You made that point about how actually Major League Baseball killed it when they took all the black players.
Yes.
But it's a great American story of resolve, dedication, and determination, all they went through and being denied. And if they had, watch this, you say Cooper Bell is 363 average or whatever. I say to you that his average might have been 375. I go just in the opposite direction that, you know, it was fear of league. No, he might have had an average of 375 instead of 363 if he didn't have to, if he could go through what the white players went through in terms of, you know, facilities and conditioning, freedom of movement, and all the stuff that he had to deal with because of the racism that kept him out, kept the brothers out. So I go just the opposite on that. And I say, you know, understand this now. Jackie Robinson died at an early 53 years old. Oh. Many would tell you that he died that death early because of the stress and the racism and all he had to do in his fight. So this applies to the same to the stats of these brothers. They could have had outstanding stats if they were able to play on the same type of playing fields and conditions and facilities and again, the freedom of movement. So and my thing is, okay, I understand a lot of people wanted these stats and all that. I don't need a white man's vindication. Okay, and I admire our independence and what we did. And I tell the story. Don't glaze over it and say something silly like DeSantis that slavery was a job opportunity and all this kind of nonsense. Tell the real story. What I want to see there, because I'm not going to sit here and rant negatively and not have a solution. What I would like to see is have a wing, because you can't do an add-on to Cooperstown. And have it just for the Negro League baseball, and tell the story, and not let Major League Baseball tell the story. Tell some historians, some of the people that just have it. Don't let Major League Baseball tell the story. Have people that have been through these type of things. I just read a great book called The Real Hoosiers.
Love that book.
Yes. Wasn't it great dealing with Oscar Robertson, man, and the stuff that went through, and this is in the 50s. It's just, I want that story told. You guys brought the point about, you know, your sons and your children are going to say, oh, that's going to start the dialogue. I don't think so, my brother. Major League Baseball has done a horrible job of reaching out to the black community and trying to promote the sport. I remember when I was doing research on one of my books and going to the rec center, I was always in there with refereeing sports. They made a half-hearted attempt. You go in there, just look at the billboard of seeing AAU, sign up for AAU. Even the NFL is doing a better job than baseball, reaching out to the minority and the kids in the community with flag football and all this. And the NFL has to overcome the injury factor that, you know what I'm saying, with the head injuries and all of that. They're doing a better job, and the numbers are far supportive. And I don't see it in baseball. I don't see the attempts. I think it's smoke and mirrors stuff. Go ahead.
Coach, you're making an argument that other people are making as well that I think is fair, which is not only is this Major League Baseball trying to whitewash its past, make amends Beautiful. Without really Thank making you. Amends. You know what I'm saying? Yes. Like making fake yes. amends. Like yes. we'll give you a statue, but not make up for the incredible economic opportunities lost.
Right.
You know, things
right.
like and, that. And, That's fair. Right. It's also right. fair and, to and, say and, that this is a kind of a cheap way to say, yes. hello, young African Americans. We have a place for you in Major League Baseball. Because the absence of black Americans in the sport right now is a scandal and a sin and an absolute slap in the face to the memories of Jackie Robinson, Henry yes. Aaron, Willie yes. Mays, of course, still with us. Yes, so yes. It is the greatest living ball player.
Yep. These and you haven't mentioned yet, and you've done your articles, your posts on this last week. There's no ownership. I mean, you know, I guess Magic is what, a minority, but there's no major, and it's never been a majority owner, and it's very scarce blacks in top management in baseball. So, you know, what are you doing here? It seems arbitrary, and it seems, you know, hypocritical with the 35 players that have been in from Satchel Paige in 71 to 2006, I think was the last time a Negro player from the league has been put in the Hall of Fame. So I'm just saying, give us a wing and let's tell the story right and let's celebrate these men. That's all I'm saying now. You know,
but you agree with Chuck and me that the marks are worthy.
Oh yeah, I'm saying that, but I'm just saying that everybody's saying rah rah rah. They're worthy. They were worthy then. They were worthy when Satchel Paige was inducted to the Hall of Fame in 71. Well, you know, so, but I don't need a vindication. I say they're worthy whether MLB acknowledges them or not. It is American success story of how that league came together and flourished despite all the hatred and bigotry and ignorance that these men had to suffer. And I want that a part of it. And don't just tell me he was .363 and he has the top batting average. You know, because you're only talking a couple of stats that are going to be where we are going to be at the top shelf of that. I want that whole story. There's some damning and frightening and just really repulsive things done during that period with these players. That needs to come out too. Tell the whole story. And baseball's a stat sport anyway, so they get carried away with that. But that's all. I'm not.
You are absolutely right that it is a stat sport. You are absolutely right that that's where, for a lot of people, that's where the vindication comes from. So, yo, we got to go to break right now. Hopefully we'll have Brother Ali on the line after this. This is The Collision, WPFW 89.3 FM.
I raise my fist. I pray all this pain might lift. I don't wanna die tonight, but I can't live another day like this. I stand tall, I raise my fist. I pray all this pain might lift. I don't wanna die tonight, but I can't live another day like this.
The first time I ever broke the law was just being born in a zone that's controlled by y'all. A foreigner in my own damn homeland made me a 16-year-old grown man. I was aged by the pain that I saw. Outside my front door was the front line of a war. Shots get fired, I cry on the floor. Underneath my bed, trying to hide from it all. I tried to recall the first time that I saw someone close to me die, and my mind starts to draw a blank as far too many of us died. Genocide, it's a genocide, and our enemies will never be satisfied until not even our memory survives. It feels like they got the whole world on their side, and the story of my people will never reach your eyes. But understand one damn thing, I can't run. I don't care where Goliath got his strength from. I'll rush your tank without even a handgun. Only a rock from the land that I stand on.
I stand tall, I raise my fist. I pray all this pain might lift. I don't wanna die tonight, but I can't live another day like this. I stand tall, I raise my fist. I pray all this pain might lift. I don't wanna die tonight, but I can't live another day like this.
That's the law that I break when I breathe.
We are back on The Collision. This is where sports and politics collide, and I am thrilled to have on the line, because we also always talk about music and hip-hop on this show. We have a legendary hip-hop artist with a 25-year career under his belt. He has a new album out called Love and Service, and he's also saying that his support for the Palestinian people has caused him to be treated as a pariah in a music industry that he has given so much to over the course of his life. We wanted to talk to him. We're thrilled to have him on the show. The positivity and the brilliance of this man cannot go be overstated. His name is Brother Ali. Hello, sir.
Peace, peace. How are you? So grateful to be here. Thank you.
Oh, man, we're thrilled to have you. Look, I would love it if, first and foremost, you could introduce yourself to our audience and talk about your journey into this space we call hip-hop.
Well, I was born in the Midwest in the late 70s. And I'm an albino, and there are albinos all over the world from every group of people. My parents are white, but I grew up in the Midwest. It was very rare to have albinism. So, you know, for people that know what albinos look like, we don't have any color or pigment in our skin and hair and eyes. So we're just kind of blank looking. Also, a lot of times we're partially or completely blind and have a lot of challenges. And so there are more albinos amongst the people in the African diaspora, though, like five times more than anybody else. So a lot of people associate albinism with the black diaspora, including black people and white people and the police. And so a lot of times people just assume that albinos are black. And so I was an outcast even as a kid, except for in the black community for kids and adults and teachers. And that has carried on for my whole life. And so from very, very early on, you know, from the first time I started coming out of my house, all the important people in my life were black, but my family is white. So I know the difference between what it's like being in my black friends' homes versus my own white home. There was also a lot of dysfunction in my house, addiction, my parents died early, things like that. And so I just really started to see America for what it thinks it is versus what it really is. The way that my black friends and families that are raising me and loving me and caring for me, the way that they're shown on TV, in the movies, how they're talked about in white homes versus who they really are. And so from a very early age, that's been my entrance into the world. And so when I discovered hip hop, it wasn't from TV. It was from being in my friends' houses and realizing like, oh, this is a format where maybe the truth will actually get out to the world. People can actually hear the genius and the full humanity and the humor and the everything about the lives that I have seen so up close and personal. And so that was my entrance into hip hop. And then through hip hop, I was introduced to Islam and I became a Muslim really young. I converted to Islam, I was a young imam in an inner city black mosque in North Minneapolis. And so the whole thing has just kind of grown and spiraled from there.
Wow, what an amazing story. Magic Mike, I know if you want to jump in at any point, please do so. I know how precious this space is to you as well. Brother Ali, something you don't know about me is that I have some roots in the Twin Cities as well. And I wanted to ask you how the scene in the Twin Cities, the home of Prince, Jimmy Jam, Terry Lewis.
Mint condition.
Thank you for that. How did the scene in the Twin Cities shape you as an artist?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very special place. I mean, all of those, you know, geniuses and luminaries that you just mentioned are in a very, very small black community that's really insulated and isolated. But there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of genius there. I mean, you just mentioned some of the greatest musicians in the whole kind of like American and black American canon and tradition. And, you know, but it's a very, very small community. Most people are from Chicago or from Gary or from some other place. There's, you know, a small neighborhood in North Minneapolis and then pockets in other parts of the city. But most of the people you mentioned are from North Minneapolis, which is where my family moved when I was 14. And that's where, you know, I became me. And there are a lot of mixed race people in the Twin Cities too. And so a number of those people, especially on the south side of Minneapolis, people that are black, white, and native, formed this record label, an independent record label called Rhymesayers, as you know, where the flagship artists and the people that run are all, you know, this like a collective group of black, white, and native and Mexican cats that started an independent label in the mid-90s. And we learned a lot from the people on the West Coast, a lot from the people on the East Coast that had done this before and in the South. And so we really helped to foster an entire network of places where we could go and perform in every city and every state across the map, but in a lot of places where hip hop artists didn't go. So, I mean, we performed in Lawrence, Kansas, and in Omaha, Nebraska, and all those little places across the whole country, where a lot of times we were going into these little punk rock bars or even country bars, and we would be the first hip hop artist there. But we were able to build a whole network like that and live for decades, almost outside the radar, almost on the periphery of the tradition. A lot of people know about Tech N9ne now, or about LP and Killer Mike now. Some of the artists from our group have actually come into the mainstream. But there's a whole network of artists that have been going directly to our fans for, you know, like you said, 25, 30 years now.
Amazing. I mean, I remember when I was in, that's exactly when I was in the Twin Cities, was in the mid-90s. So yeah, you speak with truth. Right now, Boca Veritas, you're speaking with a lot of truth about the Twin Cities, which I appreciate. Could you speak a little bit about your recent album, Love and Service, which is, by the way, a very interesting title. I'd love for you to speak about that. I know it was made in collaboration with a Jewish beat maker and animator from Ohio named Unjust. Please speak about the concept of this album.
Yeah, so it's, during the pandemic, we lived in South Minneapolis, which is where George Floyd was murdered and where the uprisings happened. Also during that time, I had made the decision to go completely independent, to no longer work with the record label where I still love everybody, Rhymesayers, but to be completely independent, to try managing my own career. My career has also taken me into a lot of like speaking and teaching and things like that. You know, in the Muslim community and around organizing and activism and justice work and all that kind of stuff. So I just kind of was seeing that I was having a different trajectory. So during the pandemic, I moved my family. My wife and I are both converts to Islam. We moved our family to Istanbul, Turkey. And so during that time, I ended up connecting with Unjust, who had been in the Bay Area working with Hieroglyphics for the last 15 years, which is one of the like luminary, you know, legendary crews of independent artists that really inspired us a lot. And so he and I connected online, and the fact that I'm Muslim and he's Jewish was just like a cool little detail. Like we weren't even really tripping about that. We more so started making an album about what it was like to live through the pandemic. The Minneapolis and like the Twin Cities hip hop community and music community went through a major call out thing, public reckoning. Some people call it cancel culture. And I really just saw how that tore up relationships, especially because it was during the pandemic where we couldn't be in space together. Some, you know, there were women that were telling really difficult stories of things that had happened to them with artists. And it just really devolved into the whole scene kind of canceling each other, disassociating from each other. It was really painful, and nobody called me out specifically, but the whole kind of community really just kind of washed its hands of each other. And me as a community builder and organizer, activist, and you know, religious person, that was really challenging, man. And so when we came here, the idea of Love and Service is that that should be what guides our interactions together. On a heart level, like what our intention is should always be love and service. So we wrote the title track, which is about, you know, cancel culture, call out culture, you know, reckoning, however you see it. That was the initial idea. And then we started making songs about people ghosting each other. We made songs about, you know, all of these different things that we were living through. And then as the album started to come to a close, that's when October 7th happened. And the fact that I'm Muslim and Jess is Jewish, but he's an very vocally anti-Zionist Jewish homie with a lot of Muslim friends living in the Bay. And even in Ohio is where Dave Chappelle is, you know, and both of, you know, and I'm really connected with Dave Chappelle's crew. So, you know, we made a song to end the album, to bring the album to a close about colonialism and specifically about what's going on in Palestine called The Collapse. Mm. And, you know, we got all of our favorite underground independent artists. Rock Marciano is on the record, who is like the king of underground independent hip hop music in this moment. Like having Rock Marciano on the project is like having Rakim in his prime. It's like having, you know, it's like having Jay-Z at, you know what I mean? It's Nas. Like Rock Marciano is that person now. He's that MC in this moment. So for him to come on the record is amazing. Aesop Rock, who's one of the all-time greats. Casual, you know, to me is like whoever is in your top five is not that interesting to me. It's like who's your top five that should be in people's top five and isn't. Mm. And to me, Aesop Rock and Casual and Rock Marcy are those guys. And also Quelle Chris is on the record. So we initially, before that, we were bringing this album to the industry before October 7th. The industry is largely people who are very sympathetic with the colonial Zionist project that calls itself Israel. But these are also people that I love and I've done business with and worked with for decades. You know, we ask about each other's children. We've been to each other's homes. These are people that I know. And we had a digital distributor that was going to distribute the record that really gassed us up. Man, Goosebumps, this is your best work. I can't believe you're making music about this stuff in this moment. The Collapse, the colonial anti-Zionist song, wasn't there yet because that moment hadn't happened yet. October 7th hadn't happened yet. And so, you know, we went from we can't wait, this is going to be your biggest project, to the distributor backing out and ghosting us. the publicist that was, you know, in the past, all of my projects have been picked up by Rolling Stone, XXL, Billboard. We've had no problem because the work we do, even if it's not in the mainstream, the story is interesting. So we've had no problem getting picked up, and all of my releases have been like that. Not a single distributor would touch this album. Not a single mainstream outlet talked about this album. None of them. Also, this year, you know, I'm usually a pretty big festival act. I played the main stage at Coachella. I played on Rock the Bells most of the years that that tour was on the road. The big, you know, reggae festivals, all of those, you know, all of the bigger festivals. This year, I have not one booking. So it's not like I went from bigger stuff to smaller stuff, because it's like, all right, Brother Ali, you never had a hit record. You're in your 40s. This might not be the highlight of your career. I understand that. So normally you go from bigger things to smaller things. But in this moment, we have zero. This is my first. The one other radio show I was on talking about this is a Palestinian radio station that's online now because they got blown up. Chuck D played my record on his radio station because he's Chuck D. Babito Garcia, the great Babito from Stretch and Barbito, he had me on IG Live. But I mean, no mainstream, you know, platforms of any kind. This is my first project with no press. This is my first this is my first summer with no festivals. This is my first project with no distributors. And it's directly related to me speaking about Palestine. From, you know, I mean, you guys just played a song that I put out in 2007 about Philistine, you know, but in this particular moment, you know, being one of the very few artists who is outspoken and actually trying to push something current. So, of course, Immortal Technique is talking about this. Of course, Saul Williams is talking about it. Of course, Dead Prez and Yasiin Bey, all these people are my dear beloved friends. But I'm actually out here trying to push a new album. I have something in this moment that I'm saying, like, yo, I'm still a very active artist that made what I think is one of my best projects, and nobody will touch it. So I'm very grateful to be talking to y'all. So, and so I mean, if I'm talking fast, it's like, man, it's the first time I got to talk to anybody about this thing.
No, I hear you. I hear you. That's quite the story here. Let me ask you, Macklemore's song, In Hall. Has that helped at least create more space for you? Because, but even that had to go viral on the, you know, Instagram social media tip more than it being played by the main stations. But do you think there's more space now than there was a month ago for what Brother Ali has to say?
It hasn't moved the needle for me at all. And much respect and love to Macklemore. I love him as a person. I knew him before he was famous. Me and the people that I mentioned are actually his favorite artists. And unfortunately, when Macklemore came along, you know, his story is very closely related to Rhymesayers. His manager was my booking agent, and I was his first client. There's a lot of closeness in that story. Unfortunately, the way that Macklemore has positioned himself is though he usually comes out as though he's the first and only artist that have talked about things and done things the way that he's done them. The way that he's done them is directly inspired by artists like myself and Sage Francis and, you know, several others that have been doing things in an atmosphere and Immortal Technique and Aesop Rock and all of these artists that we talk about. And unfortunately, you know, he has never really acknowledged publicly the role that the other artists have played. I think, well, I always think about the moment where Eminem got his first Grammy, and Eminem knew that white America had never heard somebody do complicated multi-syllable rhymes before. Because prior to that, the artists that were allowed to be on the radio were people like, and no disrespect to them, but Tone Loc and Fresh Prince and Young these MC. Artists that were, yeah, people that were doing very, very simple rhyme styles and patterns and things like that. It's very difficult for artists before Eminem to do that publicly. So when Eminem got his Grammy, because he's really of the culture, he stood on stage and read a list of people like Kool G Rap and others that inspired that, because he knew that if he didn't do that, it would almost be as though he was erasing them and taking credit for something that he had actually been taught by others. And so you, every time you see Eminem, you see him with a Redman shirt on. He's not going anywhere without saying, these are the artists that inspired me. You know, and that's asking a lot. But unfortunately, what we've seen with Macklemore, who is an amazing artist, he works very hard, extremely talented, a very nice person if you know him personally like I do. Unfortunately, the one thing that I personally as an underground artist would like to see is for him to have an acknowledgement of the artist that came before that the world doesn't know. But unfortunately, a lot of it seems to be hinged on, I'm the only one doing this. I'm the only one making a song about how materialism is bad. You know, I'm the only one making a song about how we shouldn't be unkind to LGBT folks. I'm the only one making a song about, you know, Palestine. And really allowing for himself to be seen in that way with these kind of lies of omission where you don't ever acknowledge the people that came before you, you know, because Macklemore has a star power that I just don't have. Like I've looked like, you know what I mean? Because he's beautiful and I look like this. And because he has a mind, that is a specific talent that is an important part of the whole equation, that he knows how to articulate things and to speak from a position that's very important. He's got talents that the rest of us don't have. But a lot of what he also has benefited from was being able to see a generation before him that laid a foundation for this is what this might look like for a white artist to approach hip hop in a respectful manner. You know what I mean? Or to talk about these kind of issues or even a certain type of personal introspection, you know, to where, you know, his producer, Ryan Lewis, is having long phone conversations with our studio engineer. How do you mix these songs around Brother Ali's voice so that he can speak in a really kind of vulnerable, personal way that didn't really exist in hip hop before? You know, so culture itself, it's one thing to master an industry. It's another thing to be part of culture. And culture always has this generational continuity where, you know, if you listen to the first DJ Jazzy Jeff and Fresh Prince album, he's on stage shouting out Melly Mel, Kool Moe Dee, mm-hmm. Grandmaster Caz, all the people that came before him. You know, so Macklemore's done a lot of dope stuff. But what unfortunately hasn't happened is it hasn't really opened the door for the rest of the people that have been doing this for a long time.
Well, we're going to have to talk to you again, Brother Ali. The album, there's so much to discuss. The album is Love and Service. Real quick, we only have like half a minute. How can people access your email, your website and learn more about your work and the album?
BrotherAli.com. Much love to the DMV and thank you guys so very much. I really, really appreciate it.
This is just the beginning for you and me, Brother Ali. Can't wait to talk to you more. Peace. Wow, that was Brother Ali. Coach, what do you think of that?
Wow. Hats off to the soldier, man.
What a powerful story, man. I'm so impressed. Yeah. We only have 1 minute left, Coach. I got to ask you, NBA Finals, who you cooking with?
Man, I don't like neither team. Shoot 70 trades a game. That just drives me crazy. I'm old school and I just don't like that. As for the Mavericks, I can't stand Luka for obvious reasons. I'm a referee for 30 years. He drives me crazy.
No.
Don't like him personally. But Kyrie, I'm a big fan. You wrote an excellent article within the Nation, Dave, about Kyrie and how he's changed over into a senior citizen and a leader now. And Jason Kidd, I wouldn't mind him getting a title. Mavericks in six, since we don't have time to talk about the strategy of it. Go.
All right. I as well. Mavericks in six. Luka goes nuts. Kyrie goes galactic and finishes that narrative of being just a person with a social conscience. He may have had a misstep here and there, but he's somebody who has always given a darn about the world. You see him now. Yep. He's got his keffiyeh. He's got his Palestine pendant, and he's still leaving the media so charmed, they're like little doves mm-hmm. cooing in his hand. It's a beautiful mm-hmm. thing to see. But yo,
it is.
Coach, we've just about run out of time. Anything else you want to say?
No, I wanted to the fact that, by the way, you picked Dallas when I asked you way back before the playoffs started. You had Dallas and the Knicks are, you know, that was from the heart. So you don't worry about it. You got lucky this time because you aren't very good at picking stuff.
Oh, I'm brilliant. What are you talking about? I just want to thank you so much to Magic Mike for doing an amazing job producing the show. Thank you so much to you, Coach Kevin McNutt. And yo, a big thank you to Brother Ali. I mean, it's rare we get genius on the show. No offense, Coach. And
no, hats off to the young soldier, man. No disagreement here.
To be able to talk to Brother Ali is hopefully this will be the first of many combos. Yo, for everybody out there listening, please stay frosty.
Oh, no.
Yes, I said it. It's the tagline. It's the tagline. Please stay frosty like Kyrie in the fourth quarter. We are out of here.
Wendy's commercial. Until he breathed, let him walk, but kept him on a short leash. Here he stand now, 17-year-old man child. Ain't asked nobody for a month. Hand out. He's trying to carry heaven on his back. Jump the broom with a stranger. Ain't never looked back. What he know about how the world spin? Bless his heart. He a virgin, never even had a girlfriend. Wanna be a man so bad that he can taste it. His family fell apart and he's trying to replace it. You'll find in him a heart that's second to none. But I know, oh so, that his lessons ain't done. So I stand willing to kill him again. If to grow, he got to shed his skin and let it be done.
Ain't nowhere to run. There ain't nothing here for free.
Oh, somebody's hurting my brother, and it's gone on
far too long.
Yes,
this is movement time, and when it's movement time, we can all be together.
Reverend Dr. William Barber.
We are here to announce that on June the 29th at 10 o'clock on Pennsylvania and 3rd, we are calling for the Mass Poor People's Low Wage Workers Assembly and Moral March on Washington and to the polls, June 29, 2024. We're saying the last picture of D.C. ought not be people tearing the Capitol up and trying to tear democracy down. We need a picture of folk trying to build a democracy up and lift up all people, regardless of who they are, June the 29th. On Pennsylvania and 3rd.
We won't be silent anymore.
Award-winning former police officer and criminal justice adjunct professor Garland Nixon hosts News Views Fridays at 6 p.m. Tune in to hear a refreshing angle on today's state of affairs and other issues other media intentionally overlook. Find the episodes on iTunes Podcast and Google Play Music. Only on your station for Jazz and Justice, 89.3 FM, Washington.
Do you love WPFW? Now is your chance to get involved by participating in the local station board. Run for a seat on the board by becoming a candidate between June 1st and June 30th. Complete your candidate package located on elections.pacifica.org. Call 707-500-1910 to leave a voicemail for the election supervisor.
Bump, Voices with Vision on 89.3 FM, Tuesdays at 9 a.m. for eye-opening dissection of social justice news. Listener discretion is advised because this is not for the politically faint at heart. Tell Lottie, Dottie, and everybody if you're not for the liberation of the people, fall back. Find past episodes on Player FM, iTunes Podcast, and Google Play Music. On your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW, Washington.
Sophie's Parlor is the original women's radio collective. Wednesdays from 3 to 5 p.m., the best music divas on radio at 89.3 FM and sophiesparlor.blogspot.com.
Greetings. This is Interim General Manager Miyuki Williams. Thanks to all who donated during the spring membership drive. Thanks also to those who came out to the Tacoma Station Happy Hour and our open house, allowing us to meet those we serve. If you are unable to donate during the drive, you can donate anytime at wpfwfm.org. With your support, WPFW can continue offering engaging and insightful programming, making the world better, one broadcast at a time.
Sego, this is John Kane, and I want to invite you to join me right here on WPFW on Fridays at 2 p.m. for Let's Talk Native. I will deliver guests and commentary each week on the real-life issues facing Native people. No romanticizing and no Hollywood stereotypes here. We'll talk real history and culture and life as it is and as it should be. Our shows are available as podcasts on your favorite podcast platforms and as videos on our Let's Talk Native TV YouTube channel. Find links and more at our website, www.letstalknative.com. And I'll see you here Fridays at 2 p.m. for Let's Talk Native with John Kane.
Hey, this is Matt from Martha's Table in Washington, D.C. We're throwing a fantastic Father's Day celebration, and you and your family are invited on Saturday, June 8th from 12 p.m. to 4 p.m. at Martha's Table's Commons location at 2375 El